In the book of Acts, we see Paul's work dominating the latter portion of the book. In fact, really, maybe most of the book from chapter 13 onward. And of course, he's wanting eventually to get to Rome. And at the end, he'll get there as a prisoner. But along the way, we see him being in many other places and establishing various churches. And then we see his working with them. And in the epistles, we see correspondence that he has with them. He began the missionary journeys from Antioch of Syria in Acts chapter 13, when the Holy Spirit said, "Separate Barnabas and Paul for the work that I have for them." And they come down here to this island. They go through there. This is where he struck Elymas blind. They come up into Antioch of Pisidia, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe, and then they return. That's the first missionary journey. On the second missionary journey, they split up. Barnabas takes Mark this way. Paul chooses Silas. He's going to come up through here. And we're going to be talking tonight about some correspondence that relates to this. He comes up through here, goes back, visits these churches, is forbidden by the Spirit to come down here, comes up here to Troas, picks up Luke, comes over here, establishes the church at Philippi. You're going to read about that in Acts 16. Thessalonica, Acts 17, comes down to Athens, Acts 17, and then he comes to Corinth. Corinth was the capital city of Achaia, or Greece. And it was a wicked city. It was a big city, hundreds of thousands of people estimated. And he stayed there longer than he did most places. He stayed there 1.5 years. He began, of course, as usual, in the synagogue. And when they began to oppose, he turned to the Gentiles. And many of the converts were Gentile Corinthians. He leaves there and takes Aquila and Priscilla, who he'd been with there, drops them off at Ephesus, and then he returns back this direction. Third missionary journey, Paul comes over here and goes to Ephesus, and he'll spend 2.5 to 3 years there. While there, he writes a letter, and that's something that we're going to be talking about tonight. One section of that letter, and that letter is 1 Corinthians. I had, for Wednesday night class, I'd asked you if you wanted to study Proverbs or Corinthians, and at first it was neck and neck, and all of a sudden Proverbs took off ahead. So we're going to do Proverbs on Wednesday nights, but there was some interest expressed in Corinthians. We're going to do a few lessons on Corinthians over the next few weeks as well. And I just want to give you a picture and remind you how, and if you don't, not familiar with it already, of how Acts and the epistles relate to each other. In Acts, we have the historical events happening, and in the epistles, we have correspondence from that time period. Put yourself in the shoes of the Apostle Paul. You worked there for 1.5 years. You planted that church. You brought these pagans to Christ, and now you're gone. You're over at Ephesus, and you have gotten 2 sources of information about the brethren that you worked with. And the 2 sources of information are this. One, there are reports that have come to you, and this shows up again and again in the epistle. He says, it's reported by the household of Chloe that there's division among you. And some of you are saying, I'm of Paul, and I'm of Apollos, and I'm of Cephas. He's going to say, it's reported there's fornication among you. One of you has his father's wife, and you're not doing anything about it. It's reported there's division among you at the Lord's Supper. One is hungry, another is drunk, and you're... So he's heard about the bad behavior in the church. It's not a monolithic church. It's not everybody doing this bad behavior and everybody doing this bad behavior. It's common. You've got some people that need to be reminded, don't go to prostitutes, and other people being told, no, it's okay to get married. So... But there's a lot of problems there. The other thing is they wrote him a letter. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he said, now concerning the things you wrote. So he's writing back to them. And so there's the letter that they've written. And in the letter, they have made some requests or presented some arguments or posed some questions, maybe in this particular instance with, and here's the answer we want, type of scenario. Tonight we're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, where what they want to be doing is engaging in idolatrous feasts. Now, they're not wanting to engage in this because I want to worship a pagan god. That's not what's important to them. But lots of times, and we'll find this in our lives as well, there are things that we want to do, but the thing that we want to do for some carnal or pleasure desire, it's connected with or in a connotation with or in a setting that's going to be detrimental to our spiritual benefit or somebody else's spiritual benefit. Some things are just absolutely wrong or absolutely right. If the young people tonight said, instead of sports night, what if we go around the neighborhood and door knock and invite people to church? You know, who would tell their children, I don't want you, you know, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. All right. What if they said, you know, instead of going, it's raining, instead, you know, let's go smoke pot. No, that's a bad thing. You know, so you got some things are just inherently good. Some things, no. And then you got some things in the middle, like going to Oakside and playing volleyball. But sometimes those things that appear to be in the middle might not be a good idea. As parents, we realize this. Sometimes our children want to get into things, and we stop and think, let me give you a couple scenarios. Your little bitty daughter says, I want to be a ballerina. You know, if you're not thinking, say, oh, how sweet, she wants to be a ballerina. So you get her a little tutu and you let her play. But if you think a little bit more wisely, you might think, if I encourage my daughter to be a ballerina at age 4, she might decide she likes it and keep wanting to be a ballerina at age 5 and start having dance lessons at age 6 and going in that little skimpy outfit and get all involved in the theater and ballet. And is that really where you want your 20-year-old daughter to be? Prancing around out there in those outfits and everything they're doing and wrapped up in that lifestyle. Is that a healthy direction? And so these type of things where we have to think about, is this a good idea? Where is this going? Is one of the things that makes a difference between spiritually mature people and spiritually immature people. Spiritually immature people often begin a thing with what? Why can't I do this? Spiritually mature people think more about, is this a good idea? Is this going to go in a good direction? Let's begin reading in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Excuse me, 1 Corinthians chapter 8. As he addresses things that they've mentioned in his letter, he'll begin often with these words, now concerning. Picture yourself sitting down and you're looking at a letter that's been written to you and you've answered this and you've answered that. You've dealt with this problem, you've dealt with that, and now you get to this. Now concerning things sacrificed to idols. We know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. If you have the ESV, they've done something which is helpful. A number of times in this letter, some of the phrases Paul uses in here are phrases that he's quoting or citing from the Corinthians. They've made an argument or a request or a statement, and he's responding to it. Whether it was in the letter or it's just a general Greek attitude and expressions that he's heard among the Corinthians while he's with them and such. For instance, when he tells him to stay away from fornication and he says, meat for the body and body for meats, but the body is not for fornication. He's reflecting a Greek attitude there, the Greek attitude of, well, food is made for the belly and so belly is made for food. So it's okay to eat. The implication being, the body is made, you know, with sexual capabilities, and so I should just use those wherever and whatever. So he repeats the Greek idea, and he says, but the body is not for fornication. In a minute, he's going to say, all things are lawful. Then he's going to say, but not all things edify. In this beginning statement, we know that we all have knowledge. He's not complimenting them. He's not saying, you guys are so smart. He's dealing with their excuse of why they want to be eating these sacrifices. As you read through here, it's clear in the context, they're wanting to justify it. They're wanting it to be okay. They want to do it, and their rationalization is, I have knowledge. I know the pagan idol is not real. So, there's a feast this evening down here at this pagan idol temple, and there's going to be some prime rib, you know, or some steak or some ribs or some raw, and it's going to be good. It smells good. You walked by it, you know, a bit ago, or there's a feast going on in honor of this god, or your cousin's getting married, and there's going to be some pagan idol celebrations and connected to that. And do you want to go and be part of that feast with your cousin and get all the good food and see everybody? And it, you want to be there. But it's in honor of a pagan god. So what are the Corinthians saying? But I know it's not a real god. So because I'm smart enough and because I have knowledge, I should be able to get to do it. Paul's response is this. We know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. If any man thinks that he knows anything, he knows not yet as he ought to know. But if any man loves God, the same is known by him. Concerning, therefore, the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that no idol is anything in this world, and that there is no God but one. But though there are those that are called gods, whether in heavens or on earth, and there, as there are gods many and lords many, yet to us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we unto him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we through him. Howbeit, there is not in all men that knowledge. Some, being used until now to the idol, eat as a thing sacrificed to an idol. Their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food will not commend us to God, neither if we eat not are we the worse, nor if we eat are we the better. But take heed, lest this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to the weak. For if a man sees you who has knowledge sitting at meat in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he's weak, be emboldened to eat things sacrificed to idols? For through your knowledge, he that is weak perishes, the brother for whose sake Christ died. Thus sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, ye sin against Christ. Wherefore, if meat causes my brother to stumble, I will eat no flesh forevermore, that I cause not my brother to stumble. Do you remember when he gets to chapter 13 and he describes love? One of the things he says about love is love doesn't seek its own. An immature person, a selfish person, is always seeking their own. I should be able to do this. I have a right to do this. A more mature person, a loving person, is thinking, is that good for other people within the family? You know, I want this, I want this. A more mature person is thinking, what's good for the family in a congregation? I want it this way. I want a more mature person. What's going to be better for the brethren, for the other families, for the other individuals, for the other brothers and sisters? The selfish person is always thinking like this, and some of them are thinking selfishly. So think about this first point he makes about knowledge and love. Go back and look at that in the opening part of the text. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And if you think that you know so much, he says, you still don't know what you need to know. But if any man loves God, that's who God knows. So which is more valuable there, love or knowledge? Love. Both things are important. In Hosea, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. It's not that God says, I want people to be ignorant. But between the two, which is greater? The first commandment, when they asked Jesus, what's the greatest commandment of all? He didn't say, know a whole lot and know more than other people. He said the first commandment is love God and love your neighbor. I want you to think about people that you have known. And I want to describe different categories of people, and it'll help you think about this. Have you known people who have great knowledge, but they are also very loving, considerate, humble, you know, heed correction, value other people's feelings, and they're not arrogant at all, but they're very, very knowledgeable. Have you known people like that? Have you known people who didn't have a whole lot of knowledge, but they had a very kind and loving heart? Just a good heart and wanting to do right. Maybe they haven't been a Christian as long, so they don't know as much. Maybe they're not a very good reader, and they're not as good of a student, and they don't know as many facts, but their heart's gold. Have you known people that know a lot, but they're not loving? There's no humility. They're right. You're always going to be wrong. When they're wrong, they're still not wrong. You know, and they're usually they're right, but there's a lot of knowledge, but there's no humility and love connected with it. And lastly, the least unfortunate combination of all, the ignorant and arrogant. You know, every once in a while you meet one of those where they really think they know a lot and they don't. You know, it's a brick up there, but they think it's something marvelous going on. And you've got this combination of, now think about the value that you place on each of those people and how much benefit they are to you and other people. Which combination is going to be the most beneficial to everybody around them? The one that is loving and has great knowledge. Their heart's in the right place, and so they're going to want to do the right thing, but they've got enough knowledge and wisdom to know how to do that well and help other people. Secondly, I think is going to come the person with the good heart who doesn't know as many facts. They're not as going to be a valuable of a resource for answers, but can you count on that person? And when you show them from Scripture an answer, what are they going to do? Because their heart is good, they're going to want to do that. They might not be as powerful a resource in helping with as many things, but you can just count on them. Not so valuable as the person that knows a lot of stuff, but they're not loving. You know, they may be able to answer some questions, but their benefit's really limited to other people, right? And then the final combination is just worthless, because they're wise in their own eyes and nobody else's. Knowledge puffs up. Love edifies. The person says, I've got knowledge. It's becoming selfish. Love, it's benefiting other people. He's going to say also in chapter 10, jump to the end of this discussion, verse 23. There's a lot in the intermeeting, in the parts in between, but look at verse 23 of chapter 10. All things are lawful, but not all things are expedient. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no man seek his own, but each his neighbor's good. Whatever is sold in the shambles, eat, asking no question for conscience sake, for the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. If one of them that does not believe invites you to a feast and you are disposed to go, go. Whatsoever is set before you, eat, asking no question for conscience sake. Paul's not really concerned that, did you ever, you know, stop at Burger King and get a Whopper Jr. that came from a butcher shop that bought meat from an idol temple? That's not the kind of eating meat sacrifice to idols he's working about. He says, just eat it, don't ask where it came from. But if another says to you, this has been offered in sacrifice, don't eat it for his sake that showed it and for conscience sake. Conscience, I say, not thine own, but the other's. Why is my liberty judged by another's conscience? If I partake with thankfulness, why am I evil spoken of for that which I give thanks? Whether therefore you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no occasion to stumbling, either to Jews or Greeks or to the church of God, even as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, that they may be saved. I want to illustrate this with a text we were looking at in Timothy this morning. Turn over to in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12. Let no man despise your youth. Sometimes this attitude of I want to do this, it can exist among the young or the old. But I want young people to think about this for just a moment in particular. Sometimes a young person will come along and their attitude is, well, why can't I do this? You know, mom and dad say, no, we don't want you doing that. I have a right to do this. I should have the liberty to do this. Why can't I do that? You know, what was it that the prodigal son in his immaturity wanted? Liberty. You know, give me the money. I want no responsibility. I want liberty. And so maybe you get in things, why can't I get piercings? Why can't I get a tattoo? Why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? That attitude, whether it's coming from a young person or an old person, is that seeking to edify or is that seeking our own? And this struck me this morning. I'd not really thought about this verse enough. But think about this language here in verse 12. Timothy is told, let no man despise your youth. Take just a minute and think about, what does that mean? What's he telling Timothy when he says, let no man despise your youth? One way to read that is, now Timothy, you don't let anybody, you know, ignore you. You don't let anybody say, well, you just be real assertive. And you're going to claim your territory and you're going to take it and you're going to challenge anybody. Have that attitude that some people have. In business, in the marketplace, they're just always looking to sue somebody or file a lawsuit or claim discrimination or something, you know, that kind of attitude. I don't think that's his point. Don't let anybody do that. You can't entirely control what other people are going to do, but look at the second part of the verse. Let no man despise your youth, but be an example to them that believe in word, in manner of life, in love, in faith, in purity. Another time he'll tell Timothy, flee youthful lusts. If I'm a youth and I'm engaging in youthful lusts, then what are older people going to despise in me? You know, it's like, well, that's pretty foolish. You know, there's another rebellious teenager. But Timothy is being told, you be an example in godly behavior. When a young person is being an example in godly behavior, it's kind of like Proverbs 15. A soft answer turns away wrath. Grievous words stir up anger. Okay, typically that's so. Grievous words will probably stir up anger, but what'll generally tone it down? Soft answer. Well, what's going to make people despise your youth? Rebellious, selfish, foolish, you know, attitudes that scream, me, 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 me. You know, I want to have a pink mohawk, you know, all this stuff, and then say, what are you looking at? You know, And if somebody behaves like that, then other people are going to what? And then they have something to say. I have something to say. Don't let people despise your youth. Use your youth wisely. You know, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Don't wait till you're 30 to be a decent person. Don't wait till you're 30 to be wise. Don't wait till you're 30 to. What did Paul do when he saw Timothy, who I suspect may have been a teenager when he first took it? He had a good reputation. And Paul said, I want to take him with me. Did Paul despise Timothy's youth? What caused Paul to not despise his youth? His conduct. So that's what to do. So let's read that verse again. Let no man despise your youth, but be you an example to them that believe in word and manner of life, in love, in faith, and purity. And there was good discussion this morning on just the number of times that Timothy is told, charged various things. You know, be a good example in this, behave in that, do this, do that. And as he does this, there might be somebody sometime that will despise his youth, but it's going to be their problem. It's not going to be something that he's giving them room to do. Come back to 1 Corinthians 8. Paul is going to, after he tells them this, and I want you to see the emotional desire. I want you to see the, it helps sometimes to see the wrong point of view so that you can appreciate the right point of view. If we just look at, what are those Corinthians thinking? Wanting to go to idol temple? I don't understand that. Boy, they were dumb. Well, they were pretty foolish. But there was a reason. Do you like to go to celebrations? Notice the connection with the feast. If you're invited to a feast and you want to go. There's a book about the history of Corinth and stuff. And one of the things in there is some correspondence between Gentiles, pagans. And it's talking about a dinner that was held, people invited to. And, you know, the food had been offered in honor of the god Asclepion. And now it's, you know, they're feasting on it. That was part of their culture. Do you like going to family celebrations? Do you like going to parties? Do you like going to feasts? Do you like good food? Well, often enough in Corinth, that was connected with idolatry. If you like horses, okay, and you just really like horses, you really like their salad bar, and you like their, you know, sauteed onions and steak bits or whatever, and then you find out, I don't know, Al-Qaeda bought it out or something, and a lot of people in town say, I'm not going to go to horses, you know, we're going to boycott horses, and you go, but I like horses, you know. And some people are trying to stand on a principle of protesting Al-Qaeda by it, but you're thinking, I'm not a terrorist, I just want that food. There's something they want. I want to go to this feast. I want the food. I want to be with my friends. I want to be with my family. There's some fun stuff going on there, satisfying stuff. This isn't about my religion. I'm smart enough. No, it's not a god. And so they're trying to justify it. Paul's point, don't be that small. What message are you sending when other people see you sitting at meat in an idol temple? And you recall the letter from the apostles and elders at Jerusalem, when they sent the letter out to Antioch, they said, tell the Gentiles, no, you guys, you don't need to worry about being circumcised and that stuff, but here's what you do need to do. Don't be eating blood like the Gentiles do. Don't be committing fornication. Don't be eating those idolatrous sacrifices. These people are wanting to do that. Chapter 9, he's going to give himself as an example, because he's asking them to do what? I'm asking you, Corinthians, to give up something you like to do. I'm asking you, Corinthians, to forego something you enjoy because of thinking about the bigger picture. And he says, I'm not asking you to do something I don't do myself. That's what chapter 9 is about. Let's just look briefly at it in our last few minutes here. After ending chapter 8 with this, he says, if meat causes my brother to stumble, I'm not going to eat flesh anymore that I cause not my brother to stumble. What if you converted an Orthodox Jew? You've studied with him. You know, you talked about Isaiah 53. Maybe he'd been told, well, I've been taught not to look at that passage. You know, look at it. And he's like, wow. And you study with him, and he sees it. He says, I think Jesus was the Messiah. And you show him, I need to be baptized into the Messiah. And he does that. Do you need to invite him over for ham? And put ham. Oh, look, I'm eating it. Be considerate. Now, the time may come where, you know, I heard about, I remember Melvin Curry telling about a Jew that eventually realized he could. And he said he picked up a piece of bacon. And it said, at first I felt fear, F-E-A-R, fear. He said, and I tasted it. It was good. G-O-O-D, good. But don't put a stumbling block there. When they get to the point that they realize it, but don't be trying to trip people up, because if you get somebody to violate their conscience, what does Romans 14 say? If you think it's sin, it's kind of like if your child, if you found out your child, they're sneaking around, what are you doing? And they're not disobeying you, but they thought you said, don't do that. So they're sneaking to do it anyway. That's what they need to be in trouble. Because they're defying you. Respect people's, don't try to get people to do things that are wrong. So he says, I wouldn't eat meat if it's going, I'd give up meat forever if it's going to cause my brothers to be lost. Chapter 9, verse 1. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are not you my working Lord? If to others I'm not an apostle, yet at least I am to you. My seal for the seal of mine apostleship are you and the Lord. My defense to those that examine me is this. Don't we have a right to eat and drink? Don't we have a right to lead about a wife that is a believer, even as the rest of the apostles and the brethren of our Lord and Cephas? Or I only and Barnabas, don't we have a right to forbear working? What soldier ever serves at his own charge? Who plants a vineyard and doesn't eat the fruit thereof? And he goes through and he explains, I want you to understand the evangelist does have the right to be supported. But then he says, after spending several verses showing why that's so, he says, but I didn't do this. After saying in verse 14, even so did the Lord ordain that they that proclaim the gospel should live of the gospel. But I've used none of these things. And I write not these things that it may be so in my case, for it were good for me to die, rather to die than any man should make my glorying void. If I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. For woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. For if I do this in my own will, I have a reward. But if not in my own will, I have stewardship entrusted to me. What then is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I make the gospel without charge, so as to not use to the full my right in the gospel. Now we know from 2 Corinthians, from Philippians, he was letting other churches support him so he could do this work. But he mentioned two things that he gave up. He said, I have a right to get married. But what did Paul choose to do? What did he point out in 1 Corinthians 7, where he recommended it to other people? He said, when you're married, you end up, your time is divided and your interests divided. You want to please the Lord, but you also have to spend time pleasing your spouse. He said, when you're not married, you can just be fully devoted to serving the Lord. And that's what Paul did. For those of you that are married, do we appreciate being married? Is there value in being married? Paul gave that up. Why? Could he have done all of this, particularly in the situation where he's constantly getting thrown in jail or beaten, could he have done all that with a wife and kids very well? He gave that up for the benefit of the gospel. Here he is in Corinth for a year and a half. Did he take any money from him? No. Did he have a right to? Yeah. But that wouldn't be Paul, would it? To go in there and say, I have a right. You know. Maybe say, I want to marry Phoebe. I have a right to be married. You're going to pay me. I have a right. That's not who Paul was. So when he's asking them, think beyond yourself. Don't just say, I have a right to do this. Think, is this something that's going to hinder the gospel? Is this something that's going to be helpful? He says, I give up things too. He says at the end of chapter 9, verse 19, for though I was free from all men, I brought myself under bondage to all that I might gain the more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew. Why? And this is another passage brought up this morning. That he might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law, as under the law, not being myself under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. To those without the law, as without law, not being without law to God, but under law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might gain the weak. I am become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. If you're going to be all things to all men, you can't operate from the standpoint of, I'm always going to put myself first, which is an ungodly attitude. It's, what can I do that will help with these people? For instance, when Americans go overseas, it's not effective in the gospel to go overseas and want everybody else to speak English and everybody else to serve you a hamburger. And why don't y'all do it the way we do it? That's not being all things to all men. I do, verse 23, I do all things for the gospel's sake, that I may be a joint partaker thereof. And now he's going to make a reference to the Isthmian Games. The Isthmian Games, there's an isthmus, that's a hard word, right here. It's a little skinnier than that, actually. And like the Olympics are held out here every so often, the Isthmian Games are held right here. And we give gold medals now. If you win at the price of gold, that's some significant money there, I guess. You know what they got? I don't remember which is which, but in one, there was, I think, four different games in Greece. There's two, and I think there were two others. One of them, you got a pine wreath. So somebody takes, you know, some little pieces of pine branch, and ta-da! There you go, Austin. You've trained for like 5 years, and you won. There's some pine. Another one, it was something else. I can't remember the different pieces of vegetation. But when you watch the Olympics and you see the people that win, are the people that win people who went about their training with, I want to do what I want to do? Or is it people who gave up things that they would, you know, when their friends were saying, hey, let's go do this. No, let's go to Dairy Queen. I'm going to pass on that. I'm training. You know, let's do this. Let's stay up all night. No, I need to get some sleep. I'm training. Let's go out there. No, I've got to be. It takes training, and there's rules. So listen to this illustration. Verse 24. Know ye not that they that run in a race run all, but one receives the prize? Even so run that ye may attain. And every man that strives in the games exercises what? Self-control. Self-indulgence is not the same thing as self-control. And there's a lot of people in our culture who don't have very much self-control. They specialize in self-indulgence. If you're training for the Olympics, you're not going to win if your character is based on self-indulgence. It's going to take self-control. And they do it to receive a corruptible crown. You know, all that work, and now you've... Ladies, have you ever had your husband or one of your children come and bring you a flower? Oh, that's nice. And then what happens? You know, so there's, instead of your gold medal there, you know, oh, what's all these needles and broken stuff here? Oh, that's my crown. They go to all that trouble to receive a corruptible crown. But we, an incorruptible. I therefore so run as not uncertainly, so fight I as not beating the air, but I buffet my body and bring it into bondage, lest by any means after I've preached to others, I myself should be rejected. And lastly there, he says, I don't want you to be ignorant here. Stop and think about the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. Because part of the mentality apparently the Corinthians are doing is this. This isn't my religious thing. Look, religiously I got my bases covered. I was baptized into Jesus Christ and I take the Lord's Supper. That's my religious thing. Over here at the idol temple, I'm not thinking, oh, Asclepion is such a cool god. No, that's not what I'm thinking. I'm just having a good time. That's just me having fun. This is my spiritual identity over there. So let's compartmentalize that and don't stick your nose in my business of what I'm doing outside of here. Paul's going to make the point, those people that came out of Egypt, they had a baptism. And they had some spiritual food that they took care of. But God didn't say, oh, then I'm not going to worry about their idolatry and fornication. When they started murmuring and getting involved in fornication and idolatry, he destroyed them despite their baptism and their food. Listen to the text here. I, brethren, would not have you ignorant that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all... in that sense, he's making a metaphor, baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And they all ate the same spiritual food and ate and drank the same spiritual drink. They drank of a spiritual rock that followed him. The rock was Christ. Howbeit, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. These things happened to them by way of an example. When they started murmuring and complaining, they got destroyed. When they started fooling around with sexual immorality, they got destroyed. When they started fooling around with idolatry, they got destroyed. And he says, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Have you ever seen people who they want to engage in some dubious activities? And somebody says, do you really think that's a good idea? And they say, I'm strong enough. I can handle it. Hey, let's go see this movie. Isn't that rated R? Doesn't it have that some tacky stuff? I can handle it. Hey, I'm going to go to this party. That's a rough crowd. There's going to be probably some drugs, some drink. I can handle it. Let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. And then he says, every temptation that comes to you, there's a way of escape. You see that in verse 13? There's no temptation taking you except that there's a way of escape. And then he says what the way of escape is. Look at verse 14. What's the way of escape? Run away! That's the way. It's not real complicated. Flee! I like those flee verses. Timothy was told, flee fornication. He's told, flee youthful lust. 1 Corinthians, flee fornication. Here. Flee idolatry is, pagan idol feast. Is that fleeing idolatry? No. He winds up by saying, look, don't be having fellowship with that. Over in Jerusalem, the priests, you know, there's involvement in what's going on here. That's what they're associated. Why do you want to be around the table of demons and also take the table of the Lord? All things are lawful. Not all things edify. Don't do anything causing people to stumble. Put God first. Thank you for your good attention this evening. If there's anyone subject to the invitation, won't you come as you stand and sing?